Now, this, understand, please, is a continuation, the third in a series of four seminars on Mahayana Buddhism. And I try, as far as possible, to make each seminar self-contained, so that if you miss the ones that went before, you don't find what's being said completely unintelligible. But what we're going to take up this time, under the title The Net of Jewels, is the most, I would say, advanced and mature form of Mahayana Buddhism, which is known in Japan as Kegon, K-E-G-O-N, and in China as Huayun, H-U-A-Y-E-N, and in Sanskrit as Avatamsaka, A-V-A-T-A-M-S-A-K-A. And these words all mean the doctrine of the garland. Of the garland, the wreath of flowers. And this was an attempt to make a synthesis of all Mahayana Buddhist doctrines, and including also the southern school, the Hinayana or Theravada, so as to show that all these points of view were consistent with each other, although apparently conflicting. It was perfected by a Chinese gentleman by the name of Fatsang, F-A-T-S-A-N-G, who died in 712 A.D., a man of absolutely extraordinary genius. It's curious that he's a contemporary of Huineng, the sixth patriarch of the Zen sect, who died in 713, a year later. You might say, in a way, of course, that the doctrine of Kegon is the intellectual content of Zen, because all Zen people, insofar as they have any intellectual interests in Buddhism, study the Kegon doctrine. And one of the patriarchs of the Kegon school, known as Shumitsu, was a patriarch of both schools. He lived in the Tang dynasty, rather later than Fatsang. Now, let me remind you of one thing, that Mahayana Buddhists don't have the same attitude to historical events that Christians do. For both Jews and Christians, history is enormously important. And the fact that Jesus did in fact live at a certain time, and that he taught thus and so, is considered immensely important. And therefore, all Christians tend to want to find out what Jesus really did teach and go back to the original sources. It will forever be impossible to find out what the Buddha really did teach. It is hopelessly overlaid, and that nobody could ever figure it out. Besides, the Hindus have absolutely no sense of history whatsoever. It's impossible to date the great manuscripts of Hindu tradition. And scholars have the wildest, wide variations in their guesses, as, say, to the date of the Bhagavad Gita, or anything like that. You've got a generally attested assumption that the Buddha lived shortly after 600 B.C., and that somewhere in the succeeding years, let's say, well, by about 200 B.C., the Pali texts called the Pitakas, the three baskets of the doctrine, had been formulated, probably, but nobody really knows. But then, you see, we have a whole succession of sutras which represent the various points of view of the Mahayana, which may have been written, or we might say forged, anywhere from 100 BC to 500 AD. Many of them don't exist in the original Sanskrit. We only have them in Chinese or Tibetan translations. And here is why everything is so vague. The Mahayana theory is, you see, that when the Buddha first attained his liberation, he preached the complete inner Mahayana doctrine. But nobody could understand it. So he had to come down a step and preach something for simple people. Well, this sort of thing went on. He had a deep doctrine and a simple doctrine. But as time passed, those monks who had treasured the original records of the deep doctrine released them. And so the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is a whopper of a thing, very, very subtle, appears to be in circulation roughly about 450 A.D. Goodness only knows where it came from. Nobody can possibly tell. It was simply found. It was revealed. And in the same way, of course, let's take the Book of Deuteronomy. The Book of Deuteronomy purports to be by Moses, although it describes Moses' own death. It was, as a matter of fact, unearthed in the year 621 B.C., when, as a matter of fact, it was written, because it reflects opinions and attitudes of that time, but naturally it had to be attributed to Moses. And this was not because the author of Deuteronomy was a fraud intentionally, but because he was modest. If you expound the law, you must not do so in your own name. That would be very, very cocky. You must attribute it to Moses, because Moses is the archetype of all law. So in exactly the same way, when you have very profound ideas of your own, but nevertheless you feel that you got them from a depth of consciousness which was deeper than your ego, you call that depth of consciousness, that level, the Buddha. And so naturally you attribute it to the Buddha. I must, however, explain that there are many senses in which the word Buddha is used in Mahayana Buddhists, among Mahayana Buddhists. It is used as the title of the historic Gautama Siddhartha, who we know as the Buddha, Sakyamuni, which means the sage of the Sakya clan. But then in the Lotus Sutra, which I was discussing last week, the Buddha explains that his appearance as Shakyamuni after 600 BC was a mere sort of illusion. It was an upaya, that is to say, skillful means for helping sentient beings, because the true, actual Buddha is eternal and manifests itself again and again and again in myriad universes. And so you see these glorious Tibetan and Japanese mandala paintings where you have a central Buddha surrounded with Buddhalets. You'll find, for example, Kannon, the temple of Sanju Sangendo in Kyoto, where there are 1,001 figures of Kannon, all in gold. And each one of them has 11 heads. The main head that you see from the front, and then one on each side, looking this way, one behind, looking back, and then a pile of little heads on top, all the heads being different aspects of Buddha. The center figure
has 1,000 arms, literally. All in carved wood, lacquered in gold. It's the most astonishing sight.
You wonder what this is, and you are reminded of Argus with his many eyes, of some sort of cosmic centipede, or sea urchin, or something of this kind, with tentacles all over the place. So, this point then is that behind the historic Buddha, it is worked out there are the eternal Buddha. But this eternal Buddha is diversified in many different ways. So the evolved doctrine of Mahayana, which is connected with this Kirgan doctrine, is that there is at the center what is called Mahavairocana Buddha, which means the great sun Buddha. In Japanese, Dainichi Nyorai. And this great sun Buddha has some interesting historical origins, because one suspects that it comes from Persia and is some form of Ahura Mazda, the great sun, the great light. Nobody knows, but there it is. Dainichi Nyorai, the great sun Buddha, who is always shown wearing a crown, unlike the ordinary Buddhas, which wear a sort of round cap of snails. Dainichi Nyorai is crowned and has a great blazing aureole of flames around him and holds his hand thus. Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? You know, that's what's going on, but in humans it goes one way, in the cosmos it goes another way, because the structure of a spiral nebula is this helix. Let's hold hands, you know, let's play. Then around Dainichi Nyorai there are four other Buddhas, and these are all called Dhyani Buddhas, D-H-Y-A-N-I. There is Amitayus, who is the Buddha of boundless life. There is Amitabha, opposite to him, who is the Buddha of boundless light. Then there is Amoghasiddhi, which is the Buddha of power. Siddhi meaning in Sanskrit psychic power or spiritual power. And there is Ratnasambhava, who is... Ratna means a jewel. Sambhava is completely developed. And they all are assigned different colors, different sounds, different meanings. And these five Dhyani Buddhas are supposed to constitute a symbolism of everybody's Buddha nature. That is to say, they're all in you, constituting your fundamental self. But when there appears in the world someone who is highly enlightened, he's always considered, you see, to be a manifestation of one of these five Dhyani Buddhas, or of all of them. So this is what the Buddha explains in the Lotus Sutra, that Buddha nature is the eternal principle, and that furthermore, everybody has it. Trees and grass also have Buddha nature. The very grains of dust have it. And so one of the sutras says, when every phase of our mind is in accord with the Buddha mind, there will not even be one grain of dust that does not become a Buddha. So Buddhism does in fact, contrary to some popular ideas, in this form of Buddhism, which I'm talking about this weekend, look forward to a consummation of the world in which everybody and everything becomes enlightened. And where the whole universe operates in total harmony. Now, it's difficult to understand in what kind of time this is expected to happen. I don't mean in what length of time, I mean in what kind of time. It doesn't seem to be that it will be in what we call the future. But you see, the kind of time that we are living in is only one of many possibilities of time. You know, we think, so especially, I think some scientists are too apt to assume that what we call the physical universe is really what there is and that there's nothing more than that. I find this an inconceivable assumption, that this is all there is, because we know already, you see, that there are all kinds of levels of existence outside our senses, but within the reach of our instruments. Goodness knows what there is beyond the reach of the instruments. And also in directions that we've never thought of. I mean, people develop these things in science fiction. They love to make up the idea of worlds corresponding to Riemannian spaces, because Riemann invented equations for there being ever so many different kinds of dimensions and spaces, and you can theoretically conceive this. And so the Hindus and the Buddhists feel, you see, that there are infinitely many times and kinds of time, kinds of space, kinds of world, that they may, from the point of view of our space, be coincidental with each other, that is to say, all in the same place, but there's no need for them to be all in the same place at all. You just have to let your imagination run a little bit, and there's no harm doing that, provided you know what you're doing. Because letting your imagination run, even if you know it's fantasy, will often turn up with extremely interesting results. All mathematics, for example, is simply playfulness. People who do high mathematics are not in the least bit interested as to whether they are going to attain any practical results. They're just doing things like very, very involved crossword puzzles and seeing how to manipulate them. Well, this is simply really a use of disciplined imagination. And so in the same way, many of these Buddhist fantasies are disciplined imagination going to work on the world. So in some state which they would consider the goal of things, but you may also understand the goal not as being in future time, but as being in what you might call basic time. Time behind time, time beyond time. There is the state of total fulfillment. Now, I want to read to you a description of this state, which is rather curious. It's the work of a very famous Buddhist scholar, John Blofeld, who was adventurous enough to take some mescaline and suddenly got a real shock. Because he found out practically everything he'd always known in theory. And this is a very interesting experience, because I'm not going to read all of it. He says, after some time, that he tried to visualize the Tibetan mandala of the peaceful deities that you find in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where I was describing to you a mandala, Mahavairocana in the center and the Dhyani Buddhas arranged around it, and you see them sitting inside a circle. Well, there are all sorts of these mandalas that you see in Tibetan art, and we'll go into this a good bit next weekend. But the mandala of the peaceful deities is used as a support for meditation exercise. So he tries to visualize that, but succeeded only in conjuring up some rather metallic-looking demons, although they were far from frightening and not even very lifelike or realistic, being something of a cross between metal statues and living beings. But they did convey to me, as though mockingly, that to expect a profound religious experience as a result of taking mescaline was too presumptuous. Soon after that, the sensation of a rapidly fragmenting personality returned to me with frightening force. I grew alarmed for my sanity and should have hastened to take an antidote for the mescaline had one been available. Though my friend persuaded me to eat some lunch, I was in no condition to enjoy it. By then, things seen and heard presented themselves as independent visual and oral experiences, with no seer and hearer to link them into one of those single compositions which at any given moment form the content of normal consciousness. The food went down my throat as usual, but it seemed to be disappearing into a receptacle connected with me only to the extent that it was too near to be visible. The mental stress grew agonizing. My fear of permanent madness increased, and I suffered especially from the feeling of having no inner self or center of consciousness into which to retreat from the tension and take rest. An additional discomfort was the sensation of bright lights shining now and then from behind me, as though someone were standing there flicking a flashlight off and on. The movements of my manservant, who came in several times with dishes of food, sweets, and coffee, occasioned great uneasiness. Whenever he was out of sight, I felt he might be standing behind me for some vaguely sinister purpose, and since he knew nothing of the experiment, I was afraid he would suppose that I was mad. Doubtless anyone else's uninvited presence would have made me equally distrustful and uneasy, though I was not bothered at all by the company of my friend, because he was in the know, and I felt the need of a nurse or guard. No words can describe the appalling mental torment that continued for well over an hour. All my organs and sensory experiences seemed to be separate units. There was nothing left of me at all, except a sort of disembodied sufferer, conscious of being mad and racked by unprecedented tension. There seemed no hope of being able to escape this torture, certainly for many hours, perhaps forever. Hell itself could hardly be more terrifying. About 1 p.m., I dragged myself to my bedroom, shut myself away from everyone like a sick animal, and fell on my bed. In my extremity, I suddenly made a total surrender and called upon my Idam. Now, in one of the schools of Mahayana Buddhism, it is taught that all deities, and therefore a man's own Idam, or indwelling deity, are products of his own consciousness, and that when consciousness is unimpeded by karma, it is clearly seen not to be the property of the individual, but common to all beings, to be the sole reality in all the universe. And he makes various notes on that. But anyway, this is the meaning of the Idam. It means your fundamental identity beyond all personal differentiations. So come madness or death or anything whatever, I would accept it without reservation, if only I could be freed from the tension. For the first time in my life, I ceased to cling. To cling to self, loved ones, sanity, madness, life, or death. My renunciation of myself and its components was so complete as to constitute an act of unalloyed trust in my Idam. Within a flash, my state was utterly transformed. From hellish torment, I was plunged into ecstasy, an ecstasy infinitely exceeding anything describable or anything I had imagined from what the world's accomplished mystics have struggled to describe. Suddenly there dawned full awareness of three great truths which I had long accepted intellectually, but never until that moment experienced as being fully self-evident. Now they had burst upon me, not just as intellectual convictions, but as experiences no less vivid and tangible than are heat and light to a man closely surrounded by a forest fire. 1. There was awareness of undifferentiated unity, embracing the perfect identity of subject and object, of singleness and plurality, of the one and the many. Thus I found myself, if indeed the words I and myself have any meaning in such a context, at once the audience, the actors, and the play. Logically, the one can give birth to the many, and the many can merge into the one, or be fundamentally but not apparently identical with it. They cannot be, in all respects, one and many simultaneously, not logically. But now logic was transcended. I beheld, and myself was, a whirling mass of brilliant colors and forms, which, being several colors and several forms, were different from one another, and yet altogether the same at the very moment of being different. I doubt if the statement can be made to seem meaningful at the ordinary level of consciousness. No wonder the mystics of all faith teach that understanding comes only when logic and intellect are transcended. In any case, this truth, even if at an ordinary level of consciousness it cannot be understood, can in a higher state of consciousness be directly experienced as self-evident. Logic also boggles at trying to explain how I could at once perceive and yet be those colors and those forms, how the seer, the seeing and the seen, the feeler, the feeling and the felt could all be one. But to me, all this was so clearly self-evident as to suggest the words childishly simple. Two, simultaneously, there was awareness of unutterable bliss, coupled with the conviction that this was the only real and eternal state of being, all others, including our entire experience in the day-to-day world, being no more than passing dreams. This bliss, I am convinced, awaits all beings when the last vestiges of their selfhood have been destroyed, or, as in this case, temporarily discarded. It was so intense as to make it seem likely that body and mind would be burnt up in a flash. Yet though the state of bliss continued for what I later knew to be 3 or 4 hours, I emerged from it unscathed. 3. At the same time came awareness of all that is implied by the Buddhist doctrine of dharmas, namely, that all things, whether objects of mental or of sensory perception, are alike devoid of own being, that is the word svabhava, existence as independent realities. That's what they're devoid of that. Mere transitory combinations of an infinite number of impulses. This was as fully apparent as are the individual bricks to someone staring at an unplastered wall. I actually experienced the momentary rising of each impulse and the thrill of culmination with which it immediately ceased to be. I shall now attempt to describe the entire experience in terms of sensory perception, though not without fear that this will cloud rather than illumine what has been said. For the content of my experience, being suprasensory and supra-intellectual, can hardly be made understandable in terms originally coined to describe the mental and physical content of ordinary perception. Reality, it seems to me in retrospect, can be viewed as a plasma of no intrinsic color or form that is nevertheless the substance of all colors and all forms. Highly charged with vivid consciousness, energy, and bliss, it is engaged in eternal play. Or it can be viewed not as a plasma, but as an endless succession of myriads of simultaneous impulses, each of which arises like a wave, mounts, and dissolves in bliss within an instant. The whirling colors and shapes which result produce certain effects that recall flashes of rare beauty seen in pictures, dreams, or in the world of normal everyday consciousness. It can be deduced that the latter are in fact faint reflections of this eternal beauty. I remember recognizing a well-loved smile, a well-remembered gesture of uncommon beauty, though I perceived no lips to smile, no arm to move. It was as though I beheld and recognized the everlasting abstract quality to which such transient smiles and gestures had owed their charm. Again, reality can be viewed as a god dancing with marvelous vigor, playfully, his every movement producing waves of bliss. From time to time, he makes stabbing movements with a curved knife. At every stroke, the bliss becomes intense. I remember that the plunging knife made me cry aloud, "That's it! That's right! Yes, yes, yes!" Or else reality can be viewed as a whirling mass of light, brilliant color, movement, and gaiety coupled with unutterable bliss. Those who experience it cannot refrain from laughing cries of, "Yes, yes, yes, ha, 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 that's how it is, of course, of course." I felt as though after many years of anxious search for the answer to some momentous problem, I was suddenly confronted with a solution so wholly satisfying and so entirely simple that I had to burst out laughing. I was conscious of immense joy and of incredulous amazement at my own stupidity in having taken so long to discover the simple truth. Within this play of the universe, there is endless giving and receiving, though giver, gift, and receiver are, of course, the same. It is as though two deities, who are yet one, are locked in ecstatic embrace, giving and receiving with the abandon of adoration. The Tibetan Yab-Yum representations of deities hint at this. The artists who paint them must be forgiven for their inability to indicate that giver and receiver are not only one, but formless, though indeed some artists manage to suggest the oneness by blending the figures so well that the yum is not seen unless the picture is given prolonged and careful scrutiny. During the experience, I was identical with the giver, the receiver, and the incredible bliss given and received. There is nothing sexual about this union. It is formless. The bliss is all-pervading. He should use the word genital, not sexual. And giver and receiver, giving and receiving, are not two, but one. It is only in attempting to convey the experience that the imagery of sexual joy suggests itself as perhaps coming a little closer than other imagery to the idea of an ecstatic union in which two are one. Some of the conclusions I drew from the whole experience are as follows. A. Fear and anxiety as to our ultimate destiny are needless, self-inflicted torments. By energetically breaking down the karmic propensities which give rise to the illusion of an ego and of individual separateness, we shall hasten the time when reality is revealed and all hindrances to ecstatic bliss removed, unless, like the bodhisattvas, we compassionately prolong our wanderings in samsara so as to lead other beings to that goal. B. The world around us, so often gray, is the product of our own distorted vision, of our ego consciousness and ego clinging. By casting away ourselves together with all longings, desires, qualities, and properties that pertain to them, we can utterly destroy the illusory egos which alone bar us from the ecstatic bliss of universal consciousness. The key is total renunciation. But this, alas, cannot often be achieved by a single effort of will, because each of us is hemmed in by a hard shell of karmic propensities, the fruit of many, many misspent lives. The three fires of desire, passion, and ignorance are hard to quench. Yet they would be quenched in an instant could we but make and sustain an act of total renunciation. Such an act cannot result from effort or longing, because these would involve our egos and thus actually strengthen them. Thus, in the ultimate stage, even effort and longing for nirvana must be abandoned together with everything else. This truth is hard to understand. C. The Buddha's experience indicates that when enlightenment, that is, full awareness of that blissful reality whose attributes include inconceivable wisdom, compassion, light, beauty, energy, and gaiety, is obtained in this life, it is possible to continue carrying out human responsibilities, behaving as required, responding to circumstances as they arise, and yet be free from them all. So it is with a talented actor who, in the part of Romeo, weeps real tears. When his grief for Juliet threatens to overwhelm him, he can withdraw inwardly from his role long enough to recollect the unreality of Juliet and of her death, and yet continue to give the same performance as before. D. A single glimpse of what I saw should be enough to call forth unbounded affection for all living beings. For however ugly, smelly, or tiresome they may seem, all that is real about them is that gloriously blissful, shining consciousness which formed the center of my experience. Hatred, dislike, disdain, aversion for any being sharing that consciousness, i.e. any being at all, must amount to blasphemy in one who has seen being itself. Well, now, I think anybody influenced by the Weltanschauung, the zeitgeist of the 20th century, would find great difficulty in taking such a statement seriously. Because we pride ourselves on being realistic.
That is to say, on being people who do not indulge in wishful thinking. And while at the beginning of our century, there was a great deal of what is now referred to as shallow optimism about human progress, when the two world wars came and went, we decided that human nature was pretty much of a mess. And that you will remember, no doubt, that during the Second World War, there was a theological movement generally called Back to Sin. That is to say, back to a belief in the very, very fundamental reality of evil. And that was the time when C.S. Lewis wrote the Screwtape Letters. That was the time when Reinhold Niebuhr wrote Nature and Destiny of Man. And this was saying, Westerners have got too civilized and too sentimental. You don't really admit and face the fact of how ghastly things can be. Well, now, therefore, for that reason, a description like this, which says the way things really are, is a ball without any exception whatsoever, and it is real, and you are just on vacation from it for a moment, which when you get out of it will seem like nothing, see? This is not a statement or an attitude that is coming out of anything like a sentimental culture. Nothing could be more different than the climate of Indian and Tibetan and Chinese Buddhism and the climate of New Thought at the end of the 19th century. After all, New Thought, Christian Science, Unity, all those movements were conceived in the great American prosperity of New England among very nice, successful people. And as you see today, when you go around the circles in which these very, very optimistic religions flourish, they're all composed mainly of rather well-to-do, comfortable bourgeoisie. No aristocrats ever went for them, and no proletarians. And there is a reason for this, which is that aristocrats always live on the past. Because they have arrived long ago, and therefore they have no reason to strive. A real aristocrat is a very unassuming person who doesn't lord it about, but knows that he is someone, and there's no way of questioning it. That's why they're so courteous to servants. On the other hand, a proletarian has no past and no future. And so he lives for the present. The bourgeoisie has no past, but he won't live in the present. He always lives for the future. And therefore, he's the one constantly deluded. So he is always, you see, the sucker. As my uncle used to say, the rich can afford it, the poor get it given to them, and the middle classes do without. Which was a sort of a bitter comment. But the thing is that prosperous bourgeoisie did invent and go for the philosophy that everything really behind the scenes is all right. Now, this point of view comes from a world that is so different from that. A world of extreme insecurity. Of war, of disease, of all kinds of spooks and horrors. And you see this reflected in Buddhist art. It has a class of beings in it, which are, we would say, devils. The most appalling creatures with many heads, many arms, full of claws, necklaces of skulls,
writhing serpents around them, and are described in the text to be making the most appalling noise. And there they are. That's life. But these are not demons. They're not in the Christian sense of the word devils at all. They are aspects, or shall we say wrathful aspects, of the underlying reality. And the whole point is this, and this is described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that
you have to face these things in the conviction that they are simply illusions of your own mind. But you don't try to push them away by thinking of something else, see? As if this is not to say, well, don't think thoughts like that. They're negative. When you get negative thinking, this is the different principle. You don't substitute something positive. What you do is, you go slam bang into the middle of the negative. As this man did, you see, in describing his vision when he got this awful state. He just plunged, you see, let go and plunged right into it. And, yes, he was helped by mescaline, but anybody in an awful state, say they're in pain or they're dying or something dreadful is happening, will be able to achieve the same consequence by going with it completely. I remember this wonderful German who wrote the book called Hara, you know, on Zen meditation. It's on about belly. Hara means belly. Von Durkheim, Karlfried von Durkheim. And he said to me, you know, I'm having a very interesting time because working in Germany after the awful ravages of the war has brought me some very interesting contacts. He said, I've come across a lot of people who had this tremendous spiritual illumination. And sort of when it passed off, believed that they had had some kind of a lapse of mind or hallucination under extreme stress. And when they tried to tell anybody else about it, they were laughed off. And he said there were three kinds. There was the experience of the dud bomb. You heard it coming. And there was this frightful whistle. And then there was a thud and nothing happened. But in the meantime, you knew this was it. And you gave up and surrendered completely. You just let go. And suddenly it became apparent, exactly as he says, that everything is completely gorgeous. Then he said there was a second instance. A person in a concentration camp with no sentence, no law, no nothing, absolutely convinced that he would never, never get out. Never. And he accepted it. And this same thing happened. And he said there was a third class of catastrophe, very common to people, that was to be completely uprooted. To be a displaced person with all your possessions, all your money, all your career, totally destroyed. And when some people just accepted this, the same thing happened to them. And the funny thing about it is, you see, that it's so queer because it's so difficult to pin any kind of morality on this. You see at that moment that the other people who are suffering and are resisting it and are having an awful time are not really having an awful time at all. They are actually you catch yourself doing this occasionally when you nurse a grievance and you enjoy hating somebody. You know this sort of mood? When you just revel in disliking something. So in this way, from the vision one can see life reveling in agony. It's a very weird way of looking at things. And of course, you can't carry that over into practical life and say, now I should torture you because you're going to enjoy such exquisite agony. See? You don't do that. But this is how it is seen from this particular point of view, this particular shift in consciousness. And the funny thing is, as he indicates, it's so simple. There's no question about it. It's absolutely clear. Now, this is, in other words, what we're talking about is what is the Buddhist vision of the consummation of mankind, of being, what it's all about. Hard to say when, where, from what point of view, but somewhere in rather fundamental. So you can say, well, is this a hallucination that people slip into every now and then, like getting drunk or crazy or having mumps or measles or something that just distorts your point of view and gives you what would be called euphoria? No, when you want to use a put-down word for happiness, you call a person euphoric. So you could argue that way, and it would be quite legitimate to argue that way within the zeitgeist of our times, because we are reassured by what I would call a rusty beer can view of reality. You know? It all comes down to a rusty beer can, you know? It's just, that's real, you see? That's the sort of thing you see lying on the street, and that's every day. It's folksy and terribly reassuring. But on the other hand, I keep coming back to the funny feeling that if existence itself is not basically gorgeous in this way, that it wouldn't be able to exist. That, in other words, the game wouldn't be worth the candle. That you would have a reality system which would have cancelled itself out long ago through some simple method of suicide. Now, of course, here again we can say, well, that's what it's doing. Only it's taking an unconscionable long time to do it from our point of view. You know, this is part of the God is dead bit, that you could read into that that God just couldn't stand it. This whole thing was a terrible mistake, and died and left the world hanging. And there are theologians who seriously think that God did once exist and has actually disappeared and died. This is unbelievable, but it is so. This is more or less, as I understand it, the position of Althusser. But I suppose this is one of those things that it's like nerve. A lot of people, by having nerve, get away with all sorts of things that they shouldn't get away with, but succeed in doing so. And we call them successful. They shouldn't have succeeded because they really didn't have the proper qualifications or educational background or whatever it was, but they did have nerve. Well, in the same way, you know, when you hit a golf ball, you have to have this follow-through. You really go ringo like this. You don't just hit at the ball. Well, so in a similar way, when a person has the feeling, you see, that this is the way the universe is, it gives him a certain quality of existence. And you may say, well, he's not really a very realistic person. But damn it, he gets on well.